Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Right Said Fred are one of the UK's most enduring pop exports. Formed in 1989 by brothers Fred and Richard Fairbrass, the pair have achieved over 25 million sales globally, have reached number one in 30 countries, the multi-platinum brothers went on to win two Ivor Novello Awards and one BMI Award for their hits I'm Too Sexy in 1991 and Deeply Dippy in 1992. They released 9 albums, shared stages with big names all over the world, achieved a Brit Award nomination, played in front of the Queen, and released a track for Comic Relief. Their success is global, having attracted fans all over the UK, Europe, the US, and beyond. They have had chart success around the world with their singles I'm Too Sexy, Don't Talk Just Kiss, Deeply Dippy, You're My Mate, Stand Up, and many more. Fred and Richard have co-written 6 international number one hits in countries including the US, Japan, and the UK. Up next on Celeb Savant, discussing their journey in the entertainment industry and their upcoming performance at 100% Retro in Pretoria and Cape Town, South Africa, are Richard and Fred from Right Said Fred. So where are you guys and how are you doing?
We're in Berkshire in England.
Close to Heathrow.
Yeah, sort of west of Heathrow. We're very well. We're just, I mean, the weather sucks, but we're all right.
Where and how did the name Right Said Fred come to be?
Right Said Fred is we'd got the name from a song from 1962 or three.
Yeah.
And it was sung by a British actor and comedian, Bernard Cribbins. So the song's called Right Said Fred. Yeah.
Okay. It's an old vaudevillian comedy song.
Yes.
And we had to, back in the day, we had to come up with a name because we were putting our name for the gigs in a magazine called Time Out. And that was the first name we came up with at the time. And because the band took off after that, we decided to hang on to it.
For each of you, at what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you guys realize, okay, cool, this is the path you want to take? And how did you actually connect with each other and say, oh, let's do this together?
Okay. I started playing guitar when I was about 11 or 12. 12, I think. Then Richard started learning bass when he was about a year later, 2 years later. And then we just started sort of writing and coming up with some ideas. We were never one of those bands that played other people's songs. We've always done original material, although we do subsequently have done cover versions, but we started off just doing our own songs. And it's just started like that. And we first went on the road. Christ, our first UK tour was 1978. and that was with an American electronic duo called Suicide. We've been on the road and playing a very long time.
Yeah. No, I think more than anything else, it was the prospect of getting an ordinary job that drove us into music.
Yeah, that wasn't the thing.
Yeah, I personally couldn't imagine that.
No.
Obviously, there was a period of time that you started touring and then the success came after, you know, a period of time after that. Between those times or years, what was the thing that kept you guys going? Like, okay, let's just keep going.
That's a very good question. I think in a way, we just refused to take no for an answer.
We're quite stubborn.
That's what it was. That's all it was. And even if you have a really bad night, and we had many of them at the gigs, it was never in my mind really to stop, either of us, I don't think. We just thought, well, if they can't take a joke, then fuck them.
Also, in those years, we had some very good years. So we had some very productive touring years. We were signed to Capitol EMI in America at one point. So there were indications that what we were doing was right, but we're one of those bands that it never took hold.
Yeah.
So
not until Sexy.
Yeah, not until 91 with I'm Too Sexy.
Yeah.
And we did that completely self-funding. We did that pretty much on our own, for all intents and purposes, yeah.
Borrow the money from a bank, actually, back in the day when you could actually borrow money from banks.
So that's quite interesting, because in those days, it was very much not a situation, you know, of self-funding, independent kind stuff. It was like, signed to a label, this is a process.
Yes,
so,
that's
yes.
Right.
So these days, it's quite a normal occurrence of artists doing that type of thing. Obviously, you had this motivation, you had the strength of not saying no. But was there anything that anyone or anything that or the bank who sort of pushed back and you had to fight against negativity and, you know, resistance from other people? And how did you do that at the time?
I think I remember with Sexy, we had Sexy on a demo tape, a cassette back in the day. And we actually, as you say, it was go to major labels. That's what everybody did back in the day. And so we went to major labels, and every single major label that you can name turned it down.
And
all the independents, everybody turned it down. Mm. So we didn't then think, oh, well, they must be right. We just automatically assumed they were wrong. And as it turned out, they were wrong and we were right.
Yeah.
The thing is, what I don't understand is people who sit behind a desk think they know more than the people who stand in front of an audience. I've never understood that. I've never understood that.
Yeah, you've I totally agree.
You've got to stand in front of an audience to know what you think.
Mm.
And you find that out with new songs. You know, we've had songs in the past which we really like, and you perform them, you think, this song doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
And that's happened. And subsequently, you get a song. Last year, we did a cover version of Sweet Harmony from The Beloved, and we performed that. We performed that a lot, and that song really works in front of an audience. You know, you have to, I think you have to go with your gut.
Yeah, you do. Absolutely.
So when you have a situation where a song's not working in the audience, do you throw it away completely or do you tweak it and adjust it?
We both.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Some songs, you just play it and it just, you just know, first of all, you're not enjoying playing it. And secondly, the audience aren't enjoying listening to it. So those we tend to dump. Then if there's a song that is working in bits, then we'll go back into the we'll go back into rehearsals or the studio and we'll refine it. Well, sometimes we do a segue. We had a song called Living on the Dream that did very well, but we decided to segue that with Bad Touch by Bloodhound Gang.
Yeah.
And that's how we fix that.
Also, some songs are beyond tweaking.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
They are just beyond tweaking.
Okay.
And we have had a couple of those songs. We have tried, and they come out shit every time.
Certainly. Yeah, you can't polish a turd.
You can't polish a turd.
Sorry, that's very funny. You've referenced the songs and writing. So let's dive into your creative process. From 0 to 3 to 4 minutes of that song, in the creation process, obviously you've been creating for a number of years. Is it easy every time? What motivates it? What invigorates it? You always do it together. Let's unpack your creative brains and creative processes.
Right.
We do it together.
We tend to do it together, although one of us may have the initial idea. Sometimes a song will happen in the studio, like I'm Too Sexy did. I'm Too Sexy was created in a recording studio. And other songs will happen from a title or a riff or a bass line.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm Too Sexy was very much driven by the bass line and Rich's initial lyric, I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt. And then Don't Talk, Just Kiss was a song title, which I had.
Deeply Dippy was a song title.
Deeply Dippy came from a song title. You're My Mate came from my divorce. And Richard, the opening line of that, Richard actually said to me when talking about my ex-wife, saying, I tell you what, I think she's a cow. He actually said that. And we thought...
So stuck in the song.
Yeah. Stand Up for the Champions was a co-write with a guy called Clive Ward, so that title was his. So it happens in different ways. What we tend to do is, what we find is if you do too much work on acoustic guitar, you can overwrite. You kind of forget about production techniques. So sometimes we'll get a verse and a chorus and take it into a studio, and then you start to see how the song, and you might think, oh, this needs a bridge, or this doesn't, or this just needs a production technique. So we tend to do it. We aren't very fast, and we tend to stop in between sessions and think.
Yeah,
that's what we do.
Also, sometimes it's quite good to imagine that you want to write a song of a particular style, or a particular that might be a good song to cover, or a good you know, you get something in your head, an idea, or it might just be a title. We've got a title running at the moment, which I think would make a really good mid-tempo ballad type thing, a very coverable thing. So it comes from everywhere, it really does. And Deeply Dippy actually was a title that came from a Jeeves and Wooster thing on the television. And Rob, who we were working with at the time, he picked that title. It was his idea to use that Deeply Dippy title. So that came off a TV show. So it comes from everywhere.
Yeah, and in recent times, because of
the pandemic, COVID, and some of the madness in the world. We had the song recently called Spiritual War, because we felt that that's what was happening. Some dark forces didn't have our best interests at heart. So we're at a song called Spiritual War. So it depends on what's going on around us. You know,
yeah.
I don't think we're any very that much different from other artists in that way.
So I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. For me, it's a thank you to you guys for all the hard work and the creation that you do.
Thank you.
I love the journey of the choice, the unpacking, that listening from song one to whatever number.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you're aware, massive physical upsurge all around the world. Last year, 5.9 million vinyls sold in the UK, the biggest since 1990. Also last year, there's a basket of products that they gauge exchanges on based on those exchanges for some other tax purposes. And because of the upsurge of CDs, again, that product is now back in that basket. And the research is also showing that it's the younger kids, it's the teenagers, these people who are diving into the physical world. But then we also have these streaming platforms that people consume music on. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
Well, I think there's never been a better time to get your music heard because of the internet, basically. But also, there's never been a better time to get your music recorded because you can, when we grew up, we had to go to a recording studio. We had to buy, for people that don't know, we had to buy 2-inch tape. And that was very expensive. It only had, I think, 16 minutes on it. So there were quite a lot of high outlay. So I think now there's lots of ups and lots of downs. I think the downside is that the music industry is controlled by a much smaller group of people. When we were making music, you could actually go to independent radio stations were independent. You could actually go to a station in Brighton, in England or whatever, and they were run by a small group of people. Now that's changed. And so if you aren't on the approval list of some of these corporations, you will get, not blacklisted, but you just get ignored. So I think it swings and roundabouts. And I think there's some really good examples of artists who have done extremely well because of the internet. You know, someone like the rapper Tom McDonald has really made the internet work for himself. And I think that there are really good signs in that. And on the other hand, you'll get some bands who just need a label. They're the sort of artist who need that framework. And I think it very depends on the genre and the artist.
But also what I think is interesting is that the degree to which the mainstream media are getting their knickers in a bunch over the internet and the fact they can't control it is kind of what's happened with music.
Yeah.
Which is that they can't control the kind of music that comes out on the internet. They can't. There's nothing they can do about it. You can post your up and do anything you want. And the gatekeepers back in the day thought they had it forever. And same with their mainstream media. They thought they had it forever. And they clearly never did.
Yeah.
I mean, so that from that point of view, it's actually quite a free. But Mick Jagger said, I think it's absolutely true what he said. There's never been a better time to record music, but never been a worse time to make money out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
And I think people get confused. I keep seeing online, people are comparing Spotify to radio play. It's a very different animal.
Yes.
Spotify should be much more generous with their royalties. Their royalties are disgraceful. That said, the good thing about Spotify, and I use Spotify, I use it as a sounding board. So I will be told about a band and I'll go and listen to them. If I like it, I buy it.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to download more than CDs because I travel a lot. It's more convenient, but I still buy it. And I think also it depends on the artist. Some artists I have no interest in knowing about. It'll be maybe one or two tracks. And then another artist, let's say, like, I really like Hootin' the Blowfish and Darius Rucker.
Darius Rucker.
I would be interested to read the artwork, read the credits. So I think it depends. Some people will be interested in reading about some bands and some people won't. So I think it's genre-driven, band-driven.
I remember as a kid, I bought a Steely Dan album, and on the back sleeve of the album, it gave you a list of all the equipment they use in the studio.
Yeah.
The mics, the amps, everything. And from a kid's point of view, that was fantastic. Yeah. And in a way, I think we are, you know, as Fred says, Spotify is great for sort of browsing, if you like. But the people that have been robbed and the information that's been stolen from people and it is extraordinary. So, you know, producers, writers, all the backroom boys are more invisible now than they have ever been.
Yeah.
And it's a disgrace, actually.
And I think that's why publishing's become so key, and why you see what happens now is a lot of music record producers will know there's not enough money. There's, you know, they get their 3 points, 4 points. That used to be substantial money.
Not anymore. Yes.
So now you're doing deals on publishing, or you pay cash up front because the record sales aren't there. And we've been very fortunate in recent years to have some co-writes, Taylor Swift and
yes.
Drake and Beyonce and Sophie Tucker. And obviously these people do some extraordinary numbers on their downloads and streaming. But even so, it still doesn't compare to the heyday of vinyl and physical.
No. Did you see Taylor Swift has estimated that if she plays at the inauguration for Donald Trump, she's going to charge $13.5 million.
Why? Right?
So I'm hoping she does it because she'll obviously do Look What You Made Me Do, which we co-wrote. So there's a little bit in it for us as well.
Yes.
So I have actually mentioned that we would turn up at the inauguration and do I'm Too Sexy if he wanted to. And funnily enough, with I'm Too Sexy, it suits the Trump dance. So I think we're waiting for the invite.
Yeah, yes.
I'm passionate. I read about the charts. I do research for my interviews. I'm in there. Okay. I'm not really creating, but I'm in sort of the space. Cool. A lot of people I speak to who maybe like a couple of artists, go to a couple of concerts, et cetera, et cetera, they don't know that you guys are making such little money. For example, it happened to me two times. I was speaking to a group of people, five people, 10 people. And I said to them, guys, if an artist has 50 million downloads of a song or 100 million, how much money do you think they get? And they all said a million, 50 million, all this stuff. And I said to them, well, it's actually $1,000. And they were shocked and horrified. So I think there definitely needs to be an education piece for the greater audience, for them to understand what's actually happening. So they understand this.
Yeah, I agree.
And my other point I wanted to make, so when Drake and Taylor Swift and Beyonce did all these creations with the co-write and, you know, the collaboration, were you surprised or just like, yes, this is just another step forward?
We were surprised with Taylor Swift, because in all fairness to her, and she gets quite a lot of bad press sometimes, but in all fairness to her, our personal experience with, we never spoke to her, but our experience with her.
Well, she rang us, but we hung up.
Not tonight.
No, not tonight.
So we were in touch with her people, if you like, and they were really, really nice.
Yeah, Tree Payne, I think.
Yeah, a lady called Tree Payne, and they were very communicative and responsive, and we didn't have to wait around months on end.
Same with Drake, actually.
Yeah, Drake was great. We had less communication with Beyonce because there was a misunderstanding with our publisher, so that got cleared up. But overall, we've been treated very well. So, and you can speak as you find. I mean, I think when you're an artist as big as Drake or Taylor Swift or Beyonce, you're going to get your haters. You just are.
Yeah.
And we speak from personal experience, and we've been treated pretty fairly overall.
Going back to the money thing, years ago we were working with a manager, and he said, if you imagine the music business as a triangle like that.
Yes.
Back in the day, the triangle was had a very broad base. It still had a point, but it had a very broad base. And the broad base was all the independent bands and all the smaller bands. But you still had the people at the top.
Yeah.
Now what's happening is it's a much smaller base.
Yes, it is. It's this.
It's a much narrower base. You still have vast amounts of money at the top and people making big money, but there's nowhere near the room at the bottom for all the independent bands that used to be out there. Because, I mean, in our particular case, going out with a live band costs us a fortune.
Mm. Yeah,
we were an independent band. You know, it costs us an absolute fortune now. So
that's why we do a DJ set, which is what we're doing in South Africa. You know, we have fewer people on stage because you can't, unless you're getting really extraordinary money, you can't drag a band around with you in the same way you used to be able to. You have to, and that's the great thing about technology. You can use stems, you can use technology to really help your finances on the road.
Well, we saw a clip from Bowie years and years ago, and all the brass section was on stems.
Yeah, I think it was.
Yes. Yeah, he had all the brass section. So even at level, a big auditorium, big artist, he was still looking at the bottom line.
You have to.
And you have to. You can't have a brass section standing there 2 hours playing for 10 minutes and charging you 15 grand. You can't do it.
You've referenced this. What is stems?
Stems is an audio file.
Okay.
And what it it's a raw audio file. It's not people talk in the old days. People would use backing tracks. Backing tracks would have gone through compression. They would have been processed.
Yes,
a step the raw audio file.
Oh, okay, understood.
So it sounds very different, and obviously they're all separate. So you can actually have a bass guitar on stem, and it's not the same as having a bass guitarist on stage, but it's the next best thing. Okay. So you're using backing tracks, you're not using processed sounds, you're using, to all intents and purposes, as raw a sound as you can.
And you're much more reliant on your sound man.
Yes.
Because he can mix it, he can change the tone of different things. And so back in the day when you just put you know, I mean, we have done shows off a computer, on one show, everything went wrong. We had to play it off the phone. Yeah, so and that
the contract.
Yeah, to fulfill the contract. But and that was a very different thing. You just press play and you're off. But this, you know, the sound man is going to have separate channels. He's going to have an ability to change the sound and monitor it per gig.
And I think also a lot of artists use this technology now and pretend they don't.
Mm.
And I'm not going to name them because it's not fair. But you can hear it. Like you can hear it.
Yeah.
You can hear that bass guitar is not creating that sub bass. You know, you can, and that's, and I think that's totally legitimate because music is made in a different way. And as an example, if we wanted to, with I'm Too Sexy, actually to play all the parts live, we'd need probably two percussionists on stage, possibly a DJ, possibly a drummer, then you've got bass guitar.
Yeah.
Because what you'd need is, because the way the song was recorded was with loops. I think to expect a band to recreate the record is a little bit naive because people now make records in very different ways.
Yeah.
And if you go and see, for example, if you went to see Fatboy Slim, you wouldn't expect him to have percussionists and backing.
Yeah.
Because it's crazy money. So it depends how you make the record, I think, defines how you present it on stage.
You still get old school musicians who still think that everything should be live and everything should be plugged in because they grew up with a four-piece band and which is fine. I watched some rehearsals with Dave Gilmour in Brighton recently, and when you've got that sort of money, you know he's got four backing singers, one of whom plays a harp. Wonder how difficult that is.
That's a niche market.
That's a niche market for it.
They're very niche.
Exactly. So if you've got the dosh, it is possible, but it's extremely expensive. And I think back in the day, I remember that I think they said with Pink Floyd when they're back on the road, it was the first four or five gigs that paid for rehearsals.
Mm.
Oh, and wow.
That's what you're looking at.
And I think times have changed. Yeah, you've got a band like the Sleaford Mods. They'll go out with a beer bottle and an Apple Mac or something, you know.
Yeah.
And Kanye West did Glastonbury with a laptop, you know. So I really think it's up for grabs, and I think that's pretty healthy. And we do acoustic shows, we do full band shows, we do breakdowns, DJ set shows. And I think that's I personally think that's the way to handle it.
Yeah, I think so too.
Depending on the budget.
It's all driven by money. They asked Duke Ellington years and years ago, how does he keep a great band on the road? The first thing he said was cash.
Mm-hmm.
What he said. And that's exactly. It's still true.
For the listeners, I'm speaking to Right Said Fred in January of 2024. This coming week, they're going to be performing 25. In 2025. Yes, 2025. I forgot about that. This coming week, they're going to be performing in Pretoria and Cape Town at the 100% Retro. So, guys, tell us, is it your first time coming to South Africa?
No.
This would be our third.
Third.
Oh, third. Okay.
Sorry, we were the first band in South Africa after when Nelson Mandela became prison.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And tell us, what do you enjoy about performing as part of a ensemble sort of cast or repertoire on a show like 100% Retro?
To be honest with you, what the other artists do doesn't make much difference to us. We just turn up and do what we do, and we aren't affected by who's on before, who's after. And sometimes we actually don't get much information about the show. So
not until you get there.
Yeah. So we won't know a running order. Sometimes we don't even know if we're first on, last on. To a degree, we don't care as long as we get our allotted time for a bit of a sound check and we're treated well.
Yeah.
We'll just fit in and do what we can on the day.
Also, one of the weird things about the word retro is that, as an example, they've got Rod Stewart this year at Glastonbury. Well, that's retro.
It is, yeah.
So
yeah.
I think retro as a word is becoming a little bit like the word racist. It doesn't really mean anything anymore. So you know what I mean? So I think you described the show as retro. Well, I think Glastonbury is retro. I think most shows are retro.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know? There's been this upsurge, especially from the younger people, who are nostalgic, in inverted commas, who are loving the music from the 80s or 90s when they weren't born or raised in their decades. Why do you feel there's that pull to that music and to that feeling of that music from those times?
I think some of it is because it was just really, really good, fun music.
I
think it's really simple, you know.
I mean, we live in the UK, and the UK seems to be addicted to miserable music. you know, it's horrible over here. It's horrible. This year, 100% of our live work is outside the UK.
Yeah.
Normally, it's about 90%, but this year it's 100%. And that suits us fine because we have a much better time abroad and that it tends to be much more upbeat. Also, the billing and the rostering on festivals abroad is much more imaginative than a lot of the UK stuff in our experience. And I think people are looking backwards. My daughter's 26. She loves the 80s, absolutely loves it. She listens to Nina Simone. She also listens to some contemporary stuff, but not a huge amount. Isn't really aware of the charts. She just goes from track to track, what she's got on YouTube, what's shared on WhatsApp with her friends. And I think music is just different now. And I think
we've got a bit po-faced.
Yeah,
I think we've got a bit po-faced in the UK at least. If you look at early clips of say Slade or T-Rex or Bowie Madness. Or Madness, it was, apart from anything else, it was fun and it was colourful. Mm. And I think
it was upbeat
and upbeat. I think that. We seem to have lost that, I think, over here a little bit. I think we've just got, you hear it in buskers in the street. You know, it, 9 times out of 10, you will hear something sad and depressing rather than upbeat and fun.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. It's just interesting. And also, if you look at Spotify, as we discussed earlier, they've got 100,000 new songs on every single day. So it's to sift through all that newness when there's so many brilliant classics from the 80s and 90s and so on. Well, let's just go to what we know. And it's that knowingness of that. We'll know it's going to be there. We know it's going to be good. We know it's going to be uplifting or whatever it is, compared to sifting through all this new stuff that we just don't know what it is.
That's true.
I think songwriting, I don't know about so much abroad, but certainly songwriting in the UK at the moment is a bit of an all-time low. It's really corporate. It's not very imaginative. You wouldn't get a band like Madness breaking now. You wouldn't get, I don't think, a band like Sparks breaking it now. There's a corporatization of music. It's very homogenized and dull over here. And I think people look back. I went on Spotify and I listened to the new releases from indie rock bands. I don't think they can write songs. I think the songs are dreadful.
Well, the other day I listened to Celebrate. Who did Celebrate? Celebrate.
Cool in the game. Yeah.
Suddenly, oh come on, that's a song and a half. Great line, great production, just great everything. And the golden age of bass playing for me, at least, was the 80s and disco. That's the golden age of bass playing. And some of that stuff is just, I listen to the OJs and Love Train. It cheers me every single time. Yeah. Mm. So I agree with what you were saying, actually, that a lot of that stuff in the past, and that's why back catalogue is so valuable to labels now, because they know that that's the stuff that's turning over and turning over.
It has legs.
Mm-hmm. And if you're a label and you're looking for investment, you look at back catalogue.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so I love this game. It's going to be a quick game. One of you is going to have a chance to think. I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 10 years, 5 minutes, I know your answers will be different every time. I understand that. And I recognize that. Okay. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind.
Okay.
Fred first. If you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists once you finish this conversation, and if you can't think of specific songs, just think, okay, I want to play these 5 artists. What would those 5 artists be? And if you can think of songs, what would those songs be?
At the moment, I would press play on God's Country by Sheldon Blake, LaGrange by ZZ Top, 96 Tears by The Mysterians, probably I Only Want to Be With You by Hoot and the Blowfish, and the 13th Floor Elevators.
Richard, your turn.
Well, mine would be a track called All Right by Darius Rucker, and another track by Darius Rucker called Well, that Bob Dylan song, Wagon Train.
Wagon Wheel.
Then it would be, I think, my mind's gone. I listened to, Rocky Mountain Way with
Joe Walsh.
Joe Walsh, yep. Mm-hmm. And I listened to a lot of early Peter Green. Green Melalishi and Shake Your Money Maker and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting for both of us, I think, listening to that, is it's nearly all American.
I don't listen to much English music.
No, it's nearly it's nearly all American.
Yeah,
So that is it's interesting. I'm thinking about what I listen to, and nearly everything I listen to, with one or two exceptions, I listen to some English bands like Suede and stuff like that. But mostly, it's American.
So, guys, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So, Fred, first, as a final message, what would you like to say to the audience?
What I'd like to say to the audience, first of all, thanks for almost 34 years of support.
Oh, my God, I'm nearly dead.
Which is extraordinary.
Don't say that.
We've been incredibly lucky. And being an independent artist, we've never signed a major record deal. Being an independent artist, getting that support means, I think, more to us than if we had the support of a major label.
Yeah.
And we're just very grateful. And I do actually feel blessed every day being able to make a living out of the music industry. You know, that couldn't be done unless we were
without support.
So, yes, I would just say a million thank yous. Yeah.
And my message would be, if you're feeling low, go for a walk.
Good
mental health. I'm telling you, the world is mad. The world is full of some really horrible people
mm-hmm.
who happen to have found themselves running the show.
Yes.
Those days will soon be over. So even if you're low and you're feeling like everything is on top of you, go for a walk and shake it off.
Play your favorite song.
Love it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook @CelebSavant. That's CelebSavant.